Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. Bob Berman is back in Studio A to field all of your astronomy-related inquiries. And boy, he's excited about today's show because there is plenty to talk about, including, well, in 2016, a European Space Agency mission called Gaia went up, and they are mapping a large portion of the Milky Way. And so there was a data dump this week of precise measurements of 1.7 billion stars. And Bob's pretty excited about it. Any question you have about astronomy, now's the time to call 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman here on these very airwaves, coming up after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to our airwaves to answer your astronomical questions today. You know Bob from Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. Maybe you've checked out the Old Farmer's Almanac. Well, he's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac. He has written a slew of books. The forthcoming book is Cataclysm. One of the things about Bob's books, he always has a subtitle, and I forget what it is. I know there's a supernova in it, but the new one is Cataclysm, and that'll be out soon. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Great to be here again.
You know, in the tease, I said you were excited about all this stuff, but you look very relaxed now. You're leaning back.
It's those hours on the throughway to get here.
Yeah, and you were recording Strange Universe.
Yeah, that's right, in the other studio.
So your voice is limbered up.
I guess so. We'll see.
You sound pretty good.
good, not too bad. Good. But I've always wanted a voice like yours. You've got that low radio voice, and I don't have that.
Genetics and bourbon and various other things, you know, over the years. It's a science. Well, I tell you, this they showed an image. It was all over the web, including on this website, of this map, if you will, that they made from the Gaia information. Can you tell us quickly and sort of simply what it is that happened and why everyone's so excited about it?
We're excited because there's nothing like lots of raw, correct, accurate information. That can be such a great starting point. And from there, you mine it using computers, you sift through it, you have algorithms that are looking for things. And what they did, the Europeans, is they found over 1 billion stars. Information about
the Milky Way.
Yes, all in our own galaxy. The locations, the speeds, the spectral types, in other words, what they're made of and how hot they are, and all sorts of information. So you're talking, including 7 million stars, exactly how they're moving. So with that much, you can sift through it and now say, all right, find the fastest stars. And then you'll find stars that are only passing through, that are escaping from the Milky Way, hypervelocity stars. And how do you find them? Well, this is a quick way. You just ask the computer, find me the fastest stars out of these I don't know if it's 1.3 or 1.7. We're seeing two different bits of
right.
data
and
here.
Right, and that happens on the internet. The one on NPR said 1.7, and right. I think some others said 1.3 billion. But that's
right.
Still a lot.
But yes, so you can sift through that and do original research and find out basic, amazing things that have never been available before.
And they say that they will be able to put a three-dimensional map of these stars, and that is mind-blowing in itself.
Sure. Yeah, an animation that you're flying through the galaxy. But, you know, I think after a few minutes of that, okay, you're flying past stars, and there's other stars in front of you, and the ones closer to us within a few hundred light years, you can label those. Here's Vega, here's Arcturus, here's Sirius, and then you can see where they're located as you fly past them. And that's cool. But to mine this, which are the cool stars? I don't mean in the hip sense. I mean temperature wise.
Oh, I see.
What are the low temperature stars? What are the white dwarfs?
Yeah.
There's a lot of them around us in space, an unusual amount. Well, does that keep going? Can we extrapolate? We don't have to now. With that many stars in the database, we can see, stars that have collapsed to be only the size of Earth? Yeah, they're common. They're everywhere.
Right.
We find out things like that.
Well, 1.3 or 1.7 billion, it's a lot, but it's not nearly the number in the galaxy, though, right?
That's right. And you'll read, some textbooks will say we've got 100 billion suns in our galaxy. Some say 400 billion. Some say it's even more than that. It's closer to a trillion suns. But that kind of ballpark.
So it's still a low percentage.
Yeah, we're talking about maybe, if we're lucky, 1%. Mm. But still, that's good.
It's a lot. Bob Berman is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. When's the book come out?
I don't even know. Sometime later, they have it. The publisher, Little Brown, now has it in their paws, and we just went through the first round of editing. There's three rounds of editing, and
And it's Cataclysms, and then
Cataclysm. The subtitle is something like the Supernovae, Galactic Explosions, and Earthly Mayhem that Shook Our Universe.
Oh, this will be great. All right, Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. We'll start with Ben in Glenmont. Ben, you're on.
Thank you. And first, I'd like to thank Dr. Berman for mentioning last year's solar eclipse. The family, all 50 of us, got together for a great family reunion in the Smoky Mountains. The eclipse was fantastic.
Oh, cool.
The day was one of the best days of my life, and a bear came, too.
Oh, that's
nice.
Really great. Did you say 50?
Over 50. Well, there was a large family, and it's mostly just cousins now.
Oh, cool.
That's so great. So you had clear weather, obviously, then, for the event.
Fantastic, yes.
Oh, I'm
absolutely
so glad you did. I'm so glad you went, yes. Now you know why we're so addicted and go to them around the world. You know, they're really addictive, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay, you
and
have a question.
Can't wait for the next one. In 2024, of course, we'll be playing host then. So,
oh, good for you.
To keep things simple, this is a relativistic question. When one approaches the speed of light, one travels, so-called, into the future. A similar thing happens also when one approaches high-gravity objects, such as was in the movie Interstellar. I was wondering, is there a connection or a common link between the two? One goes into the future under either scenario.
You're not really going into the future.
Yeah, that's right. Ray is right. You're not really going into the future. What happens is that your time is passing at a different rate relative to others who are not at that speed.
Right.
And it's a little tricky because if it's you who is doing the traveling, well, you'll experience your time flowing normally. You won't feel anything sped up or slowed down or in any way. But the difference is when you head towards a star that's 8 light years away, it's not going to take you 8 years to get there now. Now, you're going to get there in less than 1 year, depending upon your speed. But somebody back home watching you through a telescope would say, no, your time hasn't changed. Your length has contracted. What's happened is that the space between you and that star in front of you has shrunk.
Mm.
So that's why we say the universe is not really large or small. It doesn't have a size because the size changes depending upon things like your gravity or your speed. And yes,
very
to the caller, both of those things do it, either a stronger gravity, although they didn't do it accurately in Interstellar. But they got the idea right, that gravity can change the rate of time.
Thank you, Ben. That's an interesting concept in itself, that if you took a clock and put it way, 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 way up there, time passes at a different rate.
Absolutely, Ray. And they've done that, of course, with atomic clocks, measuring it as little as one floor above and one floor below, closer to the center of the Earth. That little bit of gravitational change has changed noticeably, changed the rate that the atomic clock keeps
time. That's not fair. You can't wrap your mind around that unless you're Einstein. Let's go to Paul in Hinsdale, Mass. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Can
you hear me?
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Bob, I enjoyed your book on biocentrism and look forward to reading a few more.
Great.
But I'm going to struggle articulating this question, which has to do with the orientation of our solar system as it spins around and then makes its 200 million year orbit around the galaxy.
Right.
Assuming there's some kind of gyroscopic effect that keeps the plane the same through the whole rotation, doesn't that change our orientation to the center of the galaxy so that the Milky Way, in fact, would 50 million years from now appear in a different plane in the sky?
No, that won't happen, to answer your question, because the planes stay the same. For example, as Earth goes around the sun, we stay in the same flat pancake-like or DVD-like orbit. Think of what it would take to actually change our orbit around the sun, change the orientation so that we're different at angle. Our actual inertia as we go around the sun, some great force would have to act on us to make us move in a different vector entirely to make us change our plane. In fact, it's called the inviolable plane of the ecliptic, because it that's the one thing never changes. You've probably read that there are things called Milankovitch cycles, where our axis changes its orientation over time, changes its direction that we point over time, shape of our orbit goes from more circular to more eccentric over time.
Yeah.
But our plane of going around the sun, the flat plane, that never changes, no matter how many millions of years. And similarly, as our solar system now goes around the center of the galaxy, you're right, every 240 million years, by the way, we're inclined 67 degrees, our solar system's plane, to the galactic disk. That also stays the same, because here you have the sun taking Earth along for the ride in the same plane, and that never changes either.
All right, I'm inclined to take a break here, so we'll do just that. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy is the topic. Number's 800-348-2551 if you have a question. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Waterwheel Village, Galloway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. WaterwheelVillage.com. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services, and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993. Offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, birthday, wedding, special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College. Providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And from the Discovery Center, presenting May 2018 programs featuring guided spring walks and exploration into the world of the Karner Blue Butterfly. AlbanyPineBush.org.
You're feeling very sleepy. Your eyes are getting heavy. It's 2:22. Stay awake for a little while, won't you? And join us here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest, and you're excited about a couple other things. We talked about Gaia, and then there's the Mars InSight, and that will hopefully go up this week.
This weekend, yeah. Saturday.
What's that about?
That's going to, for the first time, start probing seismologically, and also measurements just by the timing of the radio signals from that to Earth, any changes in the Martian tilt, and all of these things are designed to be able to have a better understanding what's under the surface.
Interesting.
Something weird happened with Mars where it apparently lost its molten core.
Right.
And because of that, the world has changed, and not for the better.
So it lost its magnetic field.
Yeah,
at
it lost
that time.
Its magnetic field. Doesn't have a global magnetic field. And so the stuff that's going on inside it is different from Earth.
Yeah.
So this is a probe designed to look at that issue.
Has there been any evidence seen of recent seismic activity on Mars?
I believe there is some. Here and there. I mean, obviously, at one time, there's a lot more because it's got the biggest volcanoes, Olympus Mons.
Right. But it's not active.
No, it's not active. Best skiing in the solar system. It's got snow on, frost on the top.
All right. And the James Webb delayed again.
Yeah, we're not fans of that.
Why are you not a fan of the James Webb telescope?
Well, for one thing, it's the replacement for Hubble, but it's an infrared telescope, not a visual telescope.
Okay.
So everybody loves the pictures that Hubble gave us. These are going to be infrared images, which means they have every single one has to be constructed falsely to get pictures. But nonetheless, infrared is important because of the universe's expansion. The most distant things have been shifted the energies into the infrared. So now this specifically is designed to detect it. But it's a little bit of a, okay, we're going to, it's an acquired taste to get into IR instead of visual images. The real problem, the real worry, and it's not my worry alone, is that this is located on the far side of the moon where no repair missions will ever be possible. And you look back, everything has needed a repair mission.
Why is no repair mission possible on the other side of the moon?
I mean, look, that would be, you'd have to launch the equivalent of a moon mission, another Apollo type thing.
We did that 45 years ago.
Yeah, I know. By spending, a nine-figure sum and
a mere bag of shells.
But in any case, it's postponed again. It was supposed to be launched, you'll recall, in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Every year there's another postponement. We've just got the latest. We were hoping for it this fall, and it wasn't that many months ago that it was postponed till next spring. That is a year from now. Now it's put off one more year beyond that.
Okay.
Now, the big worry is that every time it's put off, the price goes up, and it's crowding out other projects, other missions, because there's not a lot of money being, in fact, NASA's being trimmed, is being cut.
Well, so, as a practical matter, taking the other side of it here, if they've already put hundreds of millions of dollars in this project, wouldn't you like to see it go?
Yes, of course. And at this point, of course, you have to keep going with it, and you should keep going. And every new mission, complex mission, has stuff you got to work around and fix. And you know, I get that. But because the current administration has expressed more interest in the moon than in some of the other amazing missions, like many blue ribbon panels have said that the most important thing we should do in the next 10 years is WFIRST. WFIRST is also an infrared mission, but this one will look for dark energy, the most mysterious aspect of the universe, and it's designed to really solve deep questions. Now, you don't want to cancel that and instead send some mission back to the moon.
You just don't
want to do that. But that's the direction they're going. And if James Webb keeps being more and more expensive, they're really going to say, okay, we can't afford some of the biggies. And that's one of the biggies we're worried about being canceled.
All right, Bob Berman, a couple of quick emails and then back to the phones we will go. And the number is 800-348-2551. This came in at our email. It's voxpopwamc.org. This is from Zach, not the Zach the engineer, but a different Zach. Zach writes, I heard about a theoretical 50-meter lens that could be built using lunar materials and situated on the ideal environment of the far side of the moon. Does that sound realistic in the span of a few decades? With a coronagraph or starshade, could we realistically see color or cloud cover of exoplanets?
Well, realistic in terms of cost. Once you're setting up manufacturing on the moon, I don't have to tell you what kind of stuff you have to do to get these factories actually running and the material and the weight of those to do that. It's true the moon is mostly made of sand. Silicon dioxide, or silica, is the surface of the moon. And it's true that could be melted down. There's your glass, and you want to start building giant 50-meter telescope mirrors on the moon. That doesn't come easily. These days, they're done with spin casting, so you need a giant rotating. These things are heavy.
So it's not realistic in the near term.
No, and but once you've done that, the far side of the moon blocks the Earth. So you can then be shielded from the Earth's infrared, that is, its heat energy, and the light from the Earth. In fact, that's one of the reasons for James Webb going to the to where it's going. So I could see it has some appeal as to whether it's worth it. I don't know.
All right. This one came in from Mike. I thought I read once that the eighth star in the Pleiades in ancient history exploded, Nova, and on the sky. And the sky on Earth was bright for days, and that it was documented in Navajo cave paintings and written about in Chinese manuscripts. Is this a fact? And that's from Mike in Albany.
I don't know if that's a fact. I mean, the Lost Pleiad is a legend that's shared with a few cultures. And if you love the Seven Sisters star cluster, which looks a little bit like a tiny dipper, and you know all the stars, those of us who do, for example, from upper left to lower left, you know them individually. There's Atlas, Pleione, Alcyone, which is the brightest of all of them, Teigeta, Merope, Asterope, Celino, and Merope, which is surrounded by glowing blue gas.
Mm-hmm.
They're gorgeous. You know them individually. They're all spectral class B. They're all the same 410 light year distance. They were born together. It's a gorgeous thing. And they were the daughters of Atlas,
right,
in mythology. So and there's a lot of mythology in many, many cultures, some of it evil, some of it having to do with when the Pleiades are high up, that's bad luck. Bad things happen.
Oh, really?
So it's the whole thing is fascinating. The thing is, why do we say seven sisters when there are six that everybody can see? There are six that are much brighter than the others. And if you can see the seventh, you can see an eighth and a ninth as well.
Yes.
So the idea is that maybe in ancient times there was a seventh that changed its brightness, and that's what the caller is calling about.
We don't know.
And yes, but because these are unstable, newly born spectral class B stars showing emission spectra, these kind of stars can undergo stability, can change their brightness, and it's not an implausible thing at all.
All right, Bob, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551, the number. Keith in Wappingers Falls. Keith, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In October of 2017, NASA published a photograph of an object that entered our solar system, and it was identified as A2017U1. I have two questions with regards to that picture. It shows that the trajectory of the object begins to change as it approached the plane. Of our planet orbits, and immediately the trajectory change, taking it back out into space. My question is, why did the trajectory change as it approached the plane, and why did it change abruptly as it hit the plane?
Of course, I'm tempted to have, Ray hates it when I do this, I'm tempted to play with you and say, well, that was because it's a UFO mothership, because that's the implied sort of paranoia behind questions like this. Why should it have changed if it wasn't an artificial bit of intelligence? Now, remind me, is 2017 U1 the one that they imaged that was like long and cigar-shaped?
Yes,
yes. Okay, I remember it. And it also had a very fast speed, an unusual speed, as it went into the solar system, as I remember.
That's right.
So it actually had an extra solar system origin. It came from outside of our solar system. Now, what you're saying is that
No, I'm not saying. I'm asking a question.
Oh, okay. But you did say that its trajectory changed. And I'm not doubting you, but I didn't, in following it, in fact, we carried it on the community observatory where I was a commentator. We actually tracked it. We showed it on SLU at that time. Maybe the caller is familiar with that. But I was not aware that its trajectory, I know that it was fast. I know that it came in and then went out of the solar system, never to return. And I know it was cigar-shaped. But I do not recall that it changed its vector. Now, usually when something like that happens, it's one of the giant planets, usually Jupiter, that's responsible. That kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah.
And so you'd have two choices here. Either it was a gravitational change, I mean, assuming that it really changed its trajectory in an odd way, or and this would have been in all the periodicals that I get as well, there would have been a very strong implication that it was artificial,
right,
and not real. And since I've not seen that in any publication, including those that I'm an editor for, where we get all this stuff, including the strange stuff, I have to sit here and be a little skeptical as to whether that happened and how it happened, caller. So let me just finish by saying, because I don't want to contradict you, let me just say I can't answer that because I don't have the data.
All right, Keith, thank you so much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Now, if it comes back in a couple of weeks, man! All right, let's go to Patrick in Utica. Patrick, you're on.
I got a two-parter. First is the back several years ago, I guess about 5 years ago, there was a large asteroid that entered the atmosphere over Russia and, got everyone's attention. Yep. And then a couple of weeks ago, I think it was around like April 14th, April 15th, there was an object about three to six times as large as the Tunguska object that passed half a lunar distance between Earth and the moon.
Right.
And because, you know, for some reason, I guess political issues were more important, this got almost no play. What I'm wondering is, between that asteroid that shook everybody up when it did its airburst over Russia a few years ago, and now with what happened a couple of weeks ago, has there been any change in our attention towards spotting these near-Earth asteroids earlier rather than you know, last minute? And my second question, it has to do with the redshift.
All right, let's do the first question first, and then I'll let you ask the redshift.
Sure.
Yeah, that amazing event on February 15th, 2013, a few years ago, that did burst over Chelyabinsk with the force equal to several Hiroshima-type bombs, that airburst, was amazing, came from the opposite direction as a near-Earth asteroid that same day that we were actually tracking, and this one came toward the sun.
Yep.
And similarly with another object that came closer to us than the moon more recently. So you're right about them. These do happen. More and more attention is on them. There are several automated programs that some universities have set up that look for them using automated telescopes that look for objects that are moving in the sky. And to answer your question, the interest in them has not waned. If anything, it has grown.
Yep.
As you know, there are a lot of people who say, you know, we don't want these to strike us like that without warning. Let's pay even more attention to things that could come, especially from the direction of the sun, where we might not see them until the last minute.
Now, am I wrong, or was the one that happened recently a completely unknown asteroid?
Oh, that was unknown, and so was the Chelyabinsk. That was unknown till then as well. And there, I don't have the figure in my head right now, but the percentage of objects of various sizes, you know, smaller than 50 meters, et cetera, that are previously unknown, is considerable. You know, we know about the major asteroids. We know down to a certain size they've been charted. But then when you get to the size of smaller than that, there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't know. And the proof of that is, look how often we get clobbered. I mean, we had that one in Chelyabinsk a century ago. We had the Tunguska event hitting us. And I don't have to tell you about the four major mass extinctions caused by events like the KT event.
So it's a question of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So,
it has happened, will happen.
Get your affairs in order. All right, Patrick, you have one more question.
The core of that question was, has there been any change in our efforts to detect these things between the Russian asteroid of a few years ago?
I think it's pretty high. I think that military and science, they're all looking at that.
It's high and it's always growing. But, you know, these automated programs in particular are expensive. So new capabilities are being added, but they're being added slowly.
All right. Let's do redshift and then we'll take a break. Patrick, go ahead.
Okay. At the end of the 90s, there were still a few astronomers that were skeptical that the redshift meant that the universe was expanding. Then by the late 90s, there was evidence that the more distant an object was, the more redshift they were observing, and the interpretation of that was that meant that the universe's the universe's expansion was actually accelerating. Now, you know, the explanation for the Big Bang, the simple one, is that it's a point explosion. A more sophisticated explanation is that the space itself is expanding. Now, I can't begin to wrap my head around it, but I trust these various explanations from various apparently reputable sources that claim that space itself does expand. I don't understand how that works. But my question then is, if space is expanding, then wouldn't it make sense that more distant objects would appear to be more redshifted, and so therefore would not necessarily imply an acceleration, but that the light is simply more redshifted because it's passing through more space. More space you pass through, the more expansion you're going to pass through.
Well, yes, you're perfectly right about that. And just to back up, yes, in the 90s and even earlier, people were wondering whether the redshift is entirely a velocity thing or whether it might be due to some other factors. Halton Arp was the astronomer who was most leading that crusade. He would point to examples like Stefan's Quintet, a group of five galaxies in Pegasus, where they seem a unit, five galaxies. There were tendrils of gas that looked like it connected them, that they were all together. But one of them had a redshift that was wildly different from the others.
Uh-huh.
So if it's if redshift is really has to do with expansion, you can't have a coherent cluster of galaxies where one of the five is moving at a very different rate away from us than the others are. Yeah. So we had evidence like that. Well, it turns out more sophisticated examinations, like with Hubble, showed that that one in Stefan's quintet that had a different redshift is actually a foreground object.
Okay.
Now we know. In other words, we've resolved those paradoxes, and now everybody's on board with the Big Bang. And you're right; it has to do with space expanding, not the galaxies moving. And you're also right, caller. Patrick, was it?
Patrick, yes.
Patrick, you're also quite correct that the redshift is due to the light having traveled, let's say, a very distant galaxy, 12 or 13 billion light years away. All that time that the light's been en route to us, space has expanded, and so the wavelengths have stretched out from that. So it's not really due to the fact that that galaxy is rushing away from us, because truth to tell, when the light left 13 billion years ago, the universe was much smaller than it was, and we weren't moving that fast back then. So the redshift, you're right, caller, the redshift is due to the light going through space for 13 billion years, stretching out those waves and reddening them as space has expanded. And we know it's expanding space rather than motion, because we have objects going faster than light, and that wouldn't be possible if the galaxies themselves were moving. You can't accelerate an actual galaxy to faster than light. So it has to be the intervening space that's expanding.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts. Offering annuals, perennials, vegetables, trees, and shrubs, indoor and outdoor plants, and information for landscapes and gardens. HadleyGardenCenter.com. Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, careersintransitionllc.com. The Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presenting Oedipus Recalls, a student-written and directed adaptation of Oedipus Rex, May 4th through 6th in Parker Theater, newpaltz.edu/theater. And from Empire State Youth Orchestra, presenting Repertory and String Orchestra in Concert, featuring Bernstein, Beethoven, and Bruch, this Saturday, 3 p.m., Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, esyo.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, 2:42 on a Thursday afternoon. Bob Berman is our guest on this call-in program, and the number to call in is 800-348-2551. Jamie in Amherst called in. Jamie, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask a question about the Van Allen belt around the Earth. I saw a TED Talk where the presenter was talking about not being able to leave the Earth, close orbit because of the Van Allen belt, and I didn't know what to make of it because he made it sound like we never went to the moon if we couldn't really get through those belts. Can you talk about those?
Sure. They were theorized to exist, that our magnetic field, in other words, our magnetosphere, would trap solar charged particles, protons and electrons, that would then be captured, and it would be a radiation zone. And during the International Geophysical Year that some of us older people remember, back in 1958-59, that 18-month period, they were discovered. Guess by who?
Van Allen.
So, yes, but... But here's the reason why we're not trapped on Earth by them. Number one, when we're interested in orbiting humans, like, for example, the ISS, the International Space Station, we can orbit. And that's why we have to orbit as low as we do, because we want to stay away from the main radiation belts. And that's why they're only up 250, 300 miles. We don't want to go up to 600 to 800 miles, because it could start getting too much radiation.
Okay.
Similarly, the path to the moon taken by all the Apollo astronauts was especially designed to skirt the Van Allen belt, only passed through the very fringes of it. They all wore dosimeters. They did get more radiation than you and I get just staying home, but they all had way sublethal doses. Nonetheless, Alan Bean publicly speculated afterward that maybe the reason he was suffering from leukemia, which eventually killed him, was due to the radiation he got during the Apollo program. So it wasn't nothing, but they had plotted it very carefully to minimize it and keep it at a tolerable level.
All right.
Thank you. I really appreciate that explanation.
Thanks, sure. Jamie, and we appreciate your call. It's Bob Berman today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question, let's go to Joseph in the Pioneer Valley. Joseph, you're on.
Hello there. Ray, quick word. That version of Deep Purple, that was weirdly, disturbingly beautiful.
You like that? Yeah. Samuel J. Hoffman on the theremin. That goes back to the 50s, I think.
That was awesome. Bob, this is, I wouldn't dignify this by calling it a theoretical question, but a speculative one, which is Uranus goes around the sun pole first. Is that correct?
Pole first for a quarter of its 84-year orbit, and then pole sideways for another quarter, and then the other pole first for another quarter of the 84 years, and then sideways the other way. So, in other words, yes, instead of being an axis up and down the way Earth's essentially is, tilted only 23.5 degrees, it's a 98-degree tilt, so it is sideways. But when you think of it, since it's stationary sideways, as it goes around the sun, it means sometimes it'll point right at the sun, sometimes it'll point sideways to the sun, but it's never up and down. It's sideways, yes.
Okay, so my question is it needless to say that if Earth were, all other things being equal, but Earth were going around like this, you know, within its 1 year, would life have ever been possible?
No, probably not, because you'd have
to move too fast around to stay in a good zone.
No, you're absolutely right, because then you'd have the poles that would have the sun overhead day in, day out, for months at a time. It would be absolutely broiling and unacceptable to life, while at the same time, you'd have zones like at the equator where for months at a time you'd have the sun on or near the horizon and there'd be no useful sunlight. Those areas at least could struggle the way people in Alaska do and kind of get by with a very, very low, skimpy sun. But those times of the year when the sun would be right overhead and there'd be no relief from it, it would make life hard. You're right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. What about those areas in the sort of border between the two, the very hot and the very cold? Wouldn't that be a spot where life might have taken hold? I mean, isn't there a border area between the very hot, it's like a McDLT, very hot and the very cold? Isn't there something right in between, a little sliver?
Yeah, well, when you picture that, think of the axis on its side, and then as it's changing, it's sort of a sine wave curve. It changes from being overhead to being uselessly low in the sky. But when it's if you were neither at one or the other, you'd have turns being in the other situation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very uncomfortable.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. In discussing the Mars InSight, which I believe they're trying to launch this weekend, they talk about a couple of years on the ground on Mars, and it'll be solar powered. And I know we've had solar powered things on Mars before. And then I got thinking, how much actual, compared to the Earth, the amount of whatever voltage we get from the sun or however you measure it, how much do you get on Mars?
Right. Here on Earth, the average is 1,365 watts
per
square meter on the Earth's surface when you're right under the sun.
It must be much less there.
Yes, because they're 1.5 times farther than we are, and that would you have to square that, the inverse square law for how strong the sun is. So it would be less than a third the solar capacity. But that's enough to do the job weekly. That's why we usually used RTGs on all of our spacecraft, which are radioisotope thermoelectric generators using plutonium, the heat from plutonium, to directly produce electricity. And that gives it off for decades at a time. That's why the Voyager and the Juno and the Cassini and all the, including the first Mars programs, used RTG as well. So that's what we usually use, but nice to have solar power.
Isn't that a violation of some sort of code of ethics? In other words, when you first go to Mars and you first land, you don't know what's there, and you're taking something that is fairly highly radioactive, and you're putting it on the surface, you know, just in case something's alive. Isn't that a violation of ethics?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, the radiation will go away eventually.
Cold comfort indeed from Bob Berman. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Quickly, before we take our next call, just give us a synopsis about Cataclysms, the new book that's coming out.
Oh, so I thought that, you know, people like superlatives, and it's a culture that likes action movies and violence, and so we're going through a timeline of the most, I'm trying to avoid the word violent, but the most vigorous events that affected the whole universe and then Earth, starting with the Big Bang and what that was really about, the birth of the moon, which was, we now know,
collision
with a Mars-sized object. But I also eventually get to the Black Death, the plague, the Spanish flu.
Really? How do you tie that into,
because
astronomy?
Once we get to Earth, and then four different radioactive disasters, one of which isn't a disaster yet, and hopefully it never will be, which is the how hydrogen bombs work and the buildup to the situation we have today with nuclear weapons. So there's one chapter on nuclear weapons, one about Chernobyl. A chapter about the Three Mile Island, which was it didn't cause any deaths or injuries, but still belonged in there. So that kind of thing. So
interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned the moon being formed by a collision with a Mars-sized object. I always thought the composition of the moon was fairly similar to what was on Earth, and so it was part of the Earth at one time.
See, this is the thing. When I listen to this program later, if I do, my wife is going to say, that Ray, he knows so much. It's just amazing.
That's not true.
Do you realize that, Bob, how informed Ray is? You're really right. I don't think one person 500 knows that, yes, if you analyze the moon's, not just the rocks, but you look at it's the stuff the rocks are made of, the oxygen. Now, oxygen has different isotopes. In other words, what we're breathing right now is mostly oxygen with 8 protons and 8 neutrons. But 1 in 500 bits of oxygen that are floating around us has an extra neutron, and 1 out of every 2,000 of them has 2 extra neutrons. So we call those O17 and O18. Mm-hmm. It's oxygen isotopes. Well, here's the thing. Every celestial body has its own ratio of oxygen isotopes.
So it's a signature.
Yeah, it's a greater ratio on Mars. On Mars and the moon, it's a lesser ratio on the asteroid Vesta. We know this from meteorite samples. And so it's a fingerprint. That's how we know when we have a meteorite where it came from. And on the moon, this all gets to supporting what you just said, the oxygen isotope ratio is the same as Earth's, to within 1 part in 50,000.
Huh.
So if Earth were formed by a collision with this Mars-sized body, which we believe and a lot of evidence supports, then how can the moon rocks have the same isotopic ratio that earthly rocks do? Where is the stuff? So the moon partially came from us. We understand that stuff from Earth got blasted into space. It was white hot. It coalesced to form the moon. but it was also made of this other stuff from this other object. Where is that?
Do we have any theories?
Well, there's theories that, well, maybe it was an object that formed in our part of the solar system so that it had the same ratio that we do. It was
Venus.
Yes, it was so extraordinarily similar to Earth. Even Venus has a different isotope ratio of oxygen. So the moon is extraordinary in that way, and you're right to bring that up, that it's a puzzle.
All right, let's take a call or two here before we wrap up. Russell in New Paltz. Russell, you're on.
Hello. I have just finished the book by Peter Brannan, The Ends of the World. And in it, he suggests that really only the Cretaceous extinction can be blamed on an object from outer space, although he does say that several of them probably created volcanism to such an extent that it might have contributed. Which of the four, I think you said there were four of the five.
That's right. Well, the Permian, of course, was the big one. That was 152 million years ago.
And that's where we got all the iridium in the crust?
No, that one was from what they used to call the CTT, the Cretaceous Tertiary section. That was 66 million years ago. They used to say 65, but it's been tweaked to 66. The Permian, I said 150, it's 252 million years ago.
Yeah.
That was the worst of them. That did the most damage. And the caller is quite correct that we're still not sure whether that was caused by something called the Siberian Traps, that is, huge volcanic eruptions in Siberia at that time, or whether it could have been triggered by impact. So the caller is right that not all of these extinctions were necessarily from impacts. And I say so in the book, of course.
Russell, thank you very much for the call. Let's quickly go over to Chuck in East Greenbush. Chuck, you're on.
Yeah, hello. I could listen to you every day, sir.
Thank you.
If an object were observable and they knew that it was going to impact the Earth, would it be possible for NASA to possibly film it with their cameras and jets? And what might it look like and sound like if indeed it did impact?
Well, the approaching impact really depends, of course, on the incoming speed and the size of the object. Interestingly enough,
the angle too, of course, right?
Yes, but the important thing is size first, because kinetic energy varies with the fourth power of velocity. This is very important to have the square of velocity? But in any case, the speed is more important than the mass.
Okay.
And if it's a large object, interestingly enough, you're asking what it would look like. A large object, let's say the one that came in 66 million years ago, let's say it's 15 miles across, and you were unfortunately near enough to actually see it the way the dinosaurs were in the Chicxulub area of the Mexican Yucatan Peninsula, mm-hmm. it would actually look rather slow as it came in, because what we perceive as speed depends upon whether an object shifts its entire body in a short amount of time, which is why mice appear so fast, because they shift their little furry bodies entirely in less than a second, whereas a horse moving at the same speed as that mouse, it would look absolutely downright slow.
Or a tanker plane looks like it's barely moving in
the sky. Exactly.
Or a train. But my question is, would it be all possible to film it if it was large enough with cameras on the NASA planes or from Earth?
Okay.
If,
we're almost out of...
one went destroyed, could you hear it, or would you only hear... The shock waves.
Okay. Well, you'd hear it, but remember, sound takes 5 seconds to travel a mile. So as it's approaching...
You'd be dead before you heard it.
That's right.
We are out of time. And Bob Berman, thank you so much for being with us today. You recorded a bunch of stuff for A Strange Universe, and we'll hear that, in a month or so?
Yeah, no, every Sunday.
But what you just recorded is...
Oh, yeah. No, they'll start this Sunday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, you wait pretty long.
Yeah.
What if you screw up?
Yeah. Oh, well, I do that.
Well, thank you, Bob Berman. We'll see you next time on the program. Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Weekends through May 6th at Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. Lakeview Orchard Farm Stand at Bakery at 94 Old Cheshire Road in Lanesboro, offering seasonal tree fruits and berries, honey, pies, pastries, cider, donuts, Polish specialties, including galumpki, pierogies, lakevieworchard.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thank you for the great calls and the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Colleen O'Connell, and our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Lori Selden from Mexican Radio in Schenectady and Hudson, New York, will join us to celebrate Cinco de Mayo. Well, that'll be fun. Right now, stand by for news.